From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The filmmakers Torben Bernhardt and Travis Lowe first discovered Raphael Pliche's strange and fantastical art enterprise several years ago. For more than five decades now, in an old building on State Street, Pliche has created a sweeping tableau of the cosmos. It's a sculptural pageant from basement to top floor. And Torben and Travis knew they wanted to make a film about it, but at some point, Torben says, they became as obsessed with their project as Raphael was about his. So it's taken a while to get the story right. Well, they've completed the film now. You can see it on Video West. And today in the program, we're going to talk about Raphael's otherworldly creation and just exactly what it is. Art? Propaganda? Education? Obsession? Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On State Street in Salt Lake City, Raphael Pliche has fused his story of the cosmos to the building given to him in 1969. Some of you have found the place. Most of you haven't. Those who have allowed Raphael to take them on the tour have seen a sculptural labyrinth, a pond fed by groundwater, hand-dug in the basement. There are tunnels and bridges and figures everywhere. It's strange and a little overwhelming. And Raphael knows what people are saying about him. Here he is from a new short film on our website, Video West.
Anybody has the right to believe what they want, and they can go down the street and point their finger at me and say whatever they want about me. That's how life is. And I'm in art trying to show how I think it was. And a story.
And what does he mean, how it was? Well, he means how the world works or how the universe works. Raphael is using his sculptures to explain a religious principle, his ideas, for example, about a mother in heaven. So we're talking about the short film today. Gives us a chance to talk about where Raphael Pliche's project fits. Is it outsider art? We'll mention throughout the hour, you can see the film now. It's on, as I said, on our Video West website, videowest.org. Torben Bernhardt and Travis Lowe are with us. They co-directed the film. It's called The Gospel According to Raphael, along with editor Marissa Lila. They are with the locally based film production company Oho Media. The three also produced the film Transmormon, which some of you might remember. It was featured on Video West back in 2013. Torben Bernhardt and Travis Lowe are with us here in the studio, and welcome, guys. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks, Doug.
Thank you, Doug.
I was going to start with when you first met Raphael, but I guess what I want to say is, how does it feel to have the film finished? Right?
A big relief. Yeah. We've been working on this film for an inordinate amount of time, probably 6 years all told, and been visiting his place for probably 3 or 4 additional years. So we've been thinking about this project for a long time.
It's interesting. Torben had said something not so long ago that in some ways you guys had the same kind of obsession, it seems, Raphael sort of took on. I mean, you sort of took on the characteristics of him in some way.
Yeah, I was telling Travis before this that we maybe had like the appetizer obsession to Raphael's entree. But yeah, I think I think that we have a kinship with that kind of compulsion to create and to do it in the right way. As you know, we broke I don't know how many deadlines with you guys because we weren't ready to show it and we didn't want to. And that comes from, I think, our desire to get better and to make something that we're proud of.
Yeah, and get it right.
Yeah, exactly.
So start with how you found him. How did you guys find – and I think some of the people listening will – oh, that's the dude on State Street. How did you find him?
So probably back in 2008, a friend of mine named Reed was riding his bike down the street on the sidewalk and like just made a hard stop on a dime because he saw Raphael in the window, you know, sculpting something. And he was just perplexed. Who is this guy? What are all these sculptures in the building? And he just kind of knocked on the window and Ralph looked up and came and opened the big purple door there on State Street and just let Reed in and took him on this massive tour, the grand tour, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And immediately my friend Reed said, you have to come look at this place. You know, he knew that we were working on films and he thought this would be a great candidate. And so Reed took me over there. And yeah, for 3-4 hours, Ralph took me on the grand tour and I saw the place, which is I was blown away by. And ever since then, I just kind of had the bug. I kept going back to visit. And every time you go back, a new layer reveals itself. Mm-hmm. And you find a new thing. There's a new story. There's a new part of Ralph's life that explains what he's doing. And I was just hooked.
Torben, and when you saw it, what did you think?
We need to make a documentary about this.
Yeah, like right away.
Yeah. Yeah. Travis took me. And as soon as we got done with the tour, I turned to him and said, okay, we need to make a documentary about this. And that was 6 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You say that sheepishly, but, you know, it takes whatever it takes. Come on.
It does. And I honestly, I'm proud of my, as long as I'm not doing commercial work and I'm doing work for me, I'm proud of my slowness.
Yeah.
I want to do it in the right way. And I wanted to pay tribute to Ralph's story. Yeah. And it is a story that is esoteric and has a lot of different layers to it. And it took time to unpack those and understand what our approach was going to be, you know, so
give us a setting. What is that place like? Just like lay of the land, if you can kind of explain it.
It's kind of crazy. There's more in there than you expect. It's a labyrinth. So you go in and there are three layers. You walk in. Immediately you look into the basement, which is he dug out by hand, you know, taking the dirt out with buckets. And there's a scene of the Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. And you're just kind of looking down there. Huh, interesting. You walk around and then later you realize that you go down into the basement, you walk through hell to walk into Garden of Eden. And it's just this three levels and it's a labyrinth. You wind around, you go upstairs, you go downstairs, you come back on the main floor. And it actually took me probably half a dozen visits to really get what the layout was like because it's very idiosyncratic. He's in a limited amount of space and he had to improvise like, well, I want to make this big sculpture here, so I have to build this there. And not all of it makes sense until you visit it 6 or 7 times.
Yeah.
And just stuff everywhere revealing itself to you all the time.
Yeah, Ralph once told me that he had someone come in and say, this looks like Alice in Wonderland. He said, well, you know what? I like that.
Yeah.
And it does have that kind of quality to it where it feels surreal and there's, you know, big dragons and the story of Adam and Eve and all these different things as you walk throughout. And it does have kind of a larger than life feeling. And part of that is that you don't expect it.
Yep.
Because I think an important part of setting the stage is that it's across from Coachman's. It's on 13th.
Yep.
People don't know about it. They've probably seen it and wondered what goes on in there, but haven't actually entered the building. And once you do, you enter into this world of 50 years of work.
Yeah.
And the art right next to refuse, you know, because everything he builds his art out of, he just finds.
Right.
He scraps, you know, wherever he can. And so there's mountains of wood and metal and stuff, paper, you know, right next to a massive sculpture of a dragon, you know?
Yeah. Now, I want to get this out of the way because I think this is there's this really great section in the film. Like you guys use jazz in the film at moments, and which gives you the sense that there's a kind of an improvisational nature of that form and also with the film in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But in this section, there's kind of a montage here. And it raises the question that I just want to sort of frontally address, and that is this guy crazy?
Sure.
So let's play this section because what's interesting about it is on one hand, I think there would be this inclination to dismiss this guy as just kind of a crank making this weird thing on State Street. But you hear in this moment some of the craziness, I suppose, but also a kind of self-awareness about it. So let me play this section from the film and I want to ask you about it.
I don't hear anyone telling this particular story. Because it's different and I break tradition.
They don't.
If they're not interested,
if I'm good or
people
bad,
look the other way.
If they think I'm a quack.
And that's fine.
And
I've
got all these weird ideas.
They have the
and
right
they will
to think that too.
Whatever they want, no matter what is said here.
Am I being guided in some of these things?
We assume.
I don't know.
The other guy will save
God
the history.
God creates a place for her to hide in the wilderness.
Apparently he's talking to her when he says,
it's
let
been
us
destroyed.
Create them in our image.
It's been rewritten.
But all I'm doing at the present time, I'm defending the Bible as written.
I really liked this section because it gave you a sense, you're trying to convey, at least this is what I got from it, that there is something there that seems off kilter. But then he talks about, it was that like that clip I mentioned at the that I played at the top, mm-hmm. where he's saying, I know people are going to point their fingers and stuff. So he's got enough awareness to know that people think that he's a little off. But so how did you guys address that question? Because there are, it also must have come up. We could also kind of exploit this guy if we're not careful.
Yes. I think he's fully aware of it.
Yeah.
And for us, it was just never the most interesting question. It was something that we obviously needed to address because he knows that people think that about him. And we knew that people seeing his place would think that as well. You know, and say, okay, is this guy crazy? Is he an artist? And for us, I think that when you have a project that's been going on for 50 years, mostly done privately, yeah. that it's
mostly
going,
secretly, or at least
secretly,
no one really knows.
It's going to be idiosyncratic.
Yeah.
And it's idiosyncratic because it's pure expression. It's actually him doing it devotionally and monastically to try and tell the story that he feels is important. And I think that most of us, when we begin doing art, especially when we're children, have that capacity to, you know, if most of us did art for ourselves, it would be very idiosyncratic because it would mm-hmm. be a pure expression yeah. of how we actually feel and think. But then we go through all these buffers, all these filters before we actually release something. And I think we have kind of an editing process that we go through. But when you find a site like Ralph's where he's been working on it by himself for this entire amount of time, it has a lot of layers. He's been very, very compulsively dedicated to it. He's pulled from the Vulgate Bible, from the Apocrypha, from the Book of Mormon, yeah. From various different religious texts. And it makes sense to him because it's all part of an ongoing dialogue that he has had with himself and with the texts for 47 years.
There's this moment where, because it's hard to know when this all started. What he says in the film is that, and I'm not sure if it was an epiphany that he has, but and maybe he tells a different story all the time. I can't quite tell, but at some point he stumbled upon this scripture in the New Testament, the Book of Revelation. Revelation 12, I think it was. Like, right? Yeah, is that like a clincher for him?
Yeah. It seems that Revelation 12 was a huge thing for him. And many of the sculptures that you find in his building are directly from Revelation 12.
Yeah.
And it has to do with the mother goddess, Lady Wisdom, and Satan or the red dragon pursuing Lady Wisdom to devour the sun. You know, so you get a lot of that imagery in Ralph's building. And it's hard to say why he's so interested in this particular story, but he tends to focus on the feminine deities, and he tends to focus on stories that are excised from mainstream Mormon or mainstream Christian religion.
Yeah, Ralph tells a story where he was going to get Chinese food, and for some reason, the restaurant wasn't open. So they go next door, and they're looking at a bookshop. And in the window, there's this beautiful Bible with just like gorgeous images. So he says to himself, oh, I want to go inside and look at that. So he goes inside. He asks for the book, and they bring another one out. And he opens it up he opens it right to Revelation 12, yeah. where it tells the story of Heavenly Mother. He's so interested in the book that he puts it on layaway, and he starts spending over time to be able to actually own this book. And he just keeps opening and opening to that page. And I think he felt like he had already been trying to tell the story of creation. Mm-hmm. He went back to everything that he'd done to edit it and fit Heavenly Mother into it, because he simply felt that that was an essential part of the story that was missing.
And he says he was bothered by the illustration of Lady Wisdom, and he wanted to get
corrected.
Get it right.
Yeah. How much of this is, as far as you can tell, influenced by what seems to be kind of a Mormon upbringing, or at least some sense of Mormonism?
Yeah, I think if you go back a ways and focus on the idea of personal revelation in early Mormonism, and the idea that the doctrine isn't necessarily codified and strict, you have some room for personal inspiration, imagination, speculation, and you have some freedom to explore your beliefs, your spirituality, and express them in a way that goes back to, like, you know, the Pratt brothers in early Mormon history and basically the whole context of the early days of Mormonism. And he is older, and he did grow up in the Mormon church. He's not Mormon now, but I think that really informs who he is.
Yeah, he grew up between the Mormon church and the Episcopalian. So I think that he has a variety of influences. And for him, it's not necessarily about honing in on one organization, but having the, as he says, free agency, which I think he borrows from Mormonism, to be able to look at these things and look past the organizational narratives and say, what is actually being said here?
Yeah. I want to ask you the question of whether he sees this as, I'm making art that I want people to enjoy, or I'm creating something I want people to understand. And maybe they're both the same for him in some ways. But let me play this moment from the film. Have you talk about it. I want people to get another sense of the film. By the way, you can see it all at videowest.org. But here's another moment from The Gospel According to Raphael.
It is like a museum, but it's a museum that's a school. I'm pointing out in art a basic principle of religion. I think that people need to know that they had a heavenly mother as well as a heavenly father. The Godhead is a family. The Father, the Mother, and the Son. This is why I've made the effort to do this. The reason I don't think it'll survive is because what I'm doing here is not something to make money on. I'm not trying to sell anything other than knowledge.
You get that sense of fatalism at certain moments throughout the film. He's like, I'm not sure what's going to happen to all of this. And we're going to get to that, by the way, because that's an important point. Like, what happens to this project that he's
Absolutely.
Been working on? But this, what is it for him? You know, he says it's about knowledge, but it's also clearly this dude's an artist. I mean, he's making this cool stuff. I mean, so how does he see it?
Well, I think one thing that's important to note is that for Ralph's a believer.
Yeah.
And I think he takes for granted that the story of creation is real. So building on that, then the question is, what is the actual story?
Yeah.
And so I think that he's both. I think he's trying to, through his devotion, get the story right. And his tool to do that is his art. And Ralph has a very interesting past, a lot of which we couldn't get into in the movie, but he has been, he's done every kind of crafts work you can think of. He's ground optical lenses. He was an embalmer. He's been a draftsman. He's done all different types of building. And I think he comes from that tradition where he thought, in addition to teaching art and doing art too, and I think he comes from that tradition where he is deeply religious. And when he started to stumble on these things, that was his tool. And he had the space. And I think that it's deeply devotional for him. I think that's what we're trying to get across in the film, is that yes, he is making art, but what makes him show up every single day is that he's deeply faithful.
Yeah.
And he's faithful in this story and wants it to survive, and he wants people to know about it.
I want to ask about One thing we get us, I wonder what it's like to talk to him. I'm guessing it can be maddening. He goes off and I'm getting right. And so having to interview him for a film must have been a bit of a chore from time to time. But you get, we see his wife and we get a sense of something else going on. Although I'm sure it's probably difficult to get him to dig deep. Although I don't know. I wanted to get your sense of this. She mentions his wife, how they lost. Loss was an issue for him. He lost family member, family member, family member. He lost two daughters. And that seemed to have had some sort of effect on him. What do you think the influence of that was on the way?
Yeah, absolutely. In addition to sort of his crazy past as, you know, a craftsman and a worker, he has so much tragedy in his family and as you say, has lost family members. And has had a near-death experiences himself, and he takes those as seriously as he takes any biblical text. You know, the desire to be with his family again, and in some of his near-death spiritual experiences, you know, he takes those as completely real, and I would say that those are very influential on what he's doing. You know, in heaven, there's a scene, he cut out the ceiling, and there's a huge cross holding the ceiling up, and painted on the ceiling is God. And then in each sort of edge of the cross, depictions of his family members. And so, yeah, that's a big inspiration for him, I think.
The film raises this question of whether something like this should be preserved. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. You interview Kirk
Huffaker.
Huffaker,
yeah.
Who's with the
Utah Heritage Foundation.
Utah Heritage Foundation, forgive me. To talk about whether or not something like this could be preserved, should it be preserved? Would this be something the state should maybe take over? What did you sort of discover about that process, about identifying what's worthy of something like that?
I think one of the main things is that it seems that what makes something worthy is the community.
Yeah.
What the community thinks about it and how they value it. And if the community values it like they did with Gilgal, and you have people who have will, they can come together and they can form, as Kirk says, a constituency.
Yeah.
And actually you know, create a political or community movement to save places. But the question is it valuable to other people?
Yeah.
Or and Kirk said to us in our interview, is it valuable and is it something that should be saved, or is art fleeting?
Yeah.
And something that has its season and then passes away. I think for us in the film, we were trying to create a lament that, regardless of if it gets saved or not, that we understand that people dedicate their lives to things that may be impermanent, but they still matter.
Yeah, and there's certain practical questions as well. I mean, Ralph's he inherited the building through trust. His father died early, yeah. And the will was not sorted out entirely, and so the building is reverted to the Shriners Hospital after Ralph dies. And
it's so strange, by the way. His dad gives it to him and says, you can have it all your life.
If you heard the story from Ralph, it was just a series of bad luck.
Yeah.
Just bad. Just one thing after another that led to, in the fine print, him losing out on actually owning the business at that property.
So, and it's right there on State Street. You know, it will likely be developed over time, you know, and making the case to save the block, save the building, would be difficult, and it would just – the practical matter is you would have to have money and the political will, as Torben said, to save it. And that – I mean, that one of our goals with the film is to use the film as a catalyst to get people interested in Ralph's space, go visit it and learn about it and try to build that interest.
There's a really beautiful moment – which goes to Torben, your idea of it being a lament at the end, when we sort of see this just There's no ornamentation. There's no music. It's just the sound of State Street progressing, its development. And you get a sense of, is this going to wash over this place?
Yeah. I think that's been an interest for us with every movie we've done, actually, is entropy, is the idea that people want to believe that what they're doing is permanent. We want our grandchildren to care. We want our children to care. But as things pass through time, things get lost. And Ralph knows that. He's aware that he's part of this thing and that all he can do is what's within his power. But when I look at Ralph's building and I look at the skyscrapers in Utah or in Salt Lake, I see a commonality. I see our collective desire to create life and the vibrancy that we feel within our lifetime, and the fact that ultimately a lot of those things get lost, and they get lost to history and they get bulldozed. There's tons of boom towns, ghost towns all over Utah that were once just buzzing with life, and they're not anymore. Now they're just dirt. And I think we're particularly interested in saying it still matters, that being creative within the time that you're here is inherently powerful.
Here's one more moment from the film, The Gospel According to Raphael.
Like I say, when I'm dead and I'm gone, whatever I did, if it's shoved under the rug, at least I tried to do what I thought was right during my lifetime. And if it's dead and gone, that's not my fault. There's probably a 98% chance that one day none of this will be here. And I wasted my life. But let's put it this way. We all have a choice of wasting our own life the way we want.
So there's a 2% chance. Yeah. Right. Again, that sense of fatalism that this will probably pass away. But
yeah,
what do you guys think? And here's the thing that I think would be sad. If it just became a place where sort of tittering hipsters go to laugh at the irony of this goofy guy on State Street.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
not what you want.
Well, and that's what some people do with Gilgal.
Yeah.
And as,
right.
and as you know, Doug, I've been looking into Gilgal for 5-6 years, and I've read all of Thomas Child's writings too. And what I've noted in these kind of projects is that sometimes because they are so idiosyncratic and they are so private that people lack context. And as soon as they lack context, something just becomes crazy. And you're welcome to still think it's crazy after you know the context, right? But it's certainly helpful to get a sense of that context so you can understand what the overarching goal was with the project. And I think that a lot of people approach these things superficially. They look at them and they say, oh, you know, it's just this crazy sculpture. And they don't even think about the labor involved in it. They don't think about the fact that Ralph dug to groundwater with 5-gallon buckets by himself, one by one, right? And this place obviously mattered to him. And the message matters to him. And that message might not matter to you, and you might not like his art. But to me, there's something in this symbolic effort, in the desire to create something of this magnitude, that if you're an artist or if you're a person who's tied into what your life's meaning is important. And I totally get it. Like, I get it when people go to Gilgal and just want to take a picture with the Joseph Smith Sphinx. Totally.
Yeah, that's weird.
Of course. Whatever, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And I also get it if people want to go and look at how weird his place is. But I think that's superficial. And I think that there's something on a deeper level that we can appreciate. And to appreciate something, you have to actually give it time, and you have to engage it, not just gawk at it.
Yeah. Yeah, the weirdness or the oddness or it being kind of uncanny is really just the start of a conversation for me. It's odd. I don't understand this. I want to know more. It sort of drives me to want to learn more.
It's Travis Lowe, Torben Bernhardt also with us. Go see The Gospel According to Raphael on Video West, videowest.org. We should also mention they created the film with Marissa Lila. Guys, thanks very much. Congratulations.
Hey, thank you so much, Doug.
Thanks, Doug.
We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about, well, now we're talking about outsider art. We've been talking about a strange and kind of wonderful art project. I think that's how you would call it anyway. It's 50 years in the making on State Street. Raphael Plesias hollowed out these tunnels and made these bridges and brought this space to life with these sculptures that help him explain how the universe works. So we were talking about a film created by Torben Bernhard and Travis Lowe and Marissa Lila. It's called The Gospel According to Raphael. You can see it at videowest.org. That got us thinking about where Raphael may fit in all of this, which leads us to Sean Rossiter, an artist and executive director of Artists of Utah. It's a nonprofit visual arts organization. He also serves as the editor of the magazine 15 Bytes. And Sean, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Bateman is also with us, an artist and curator, executive director of the Contemporary Art Gallery, Quack, in downtown Salt Lake City. Adam, welcome to you.
Hey, thanks, Doug.
You guys have done the tour not so long ago. I wanted to start there. Before we get to the question of is it art and what is art and where does it fit in all of those kinds of things, just like knee-jerk impression of that like crazy space.
Crazy space is right.
Yeah.
A character,
yep.
You know, taking you on that space. It was great to see. You walk into this building, you don't know what's going on, and then the floor opens up beneath you, the water's bubbling, there's stairs that you don't think are really stairs, and that's what he takes you up to go to kind of the heavenly realm.
Yeah.
And with the room comes Raphael, which is...
Yeah, it's true.
is an experience. But that's the price of admission, right?
Right.
He wants to tell you his story.
Yeah, like you can't just wander around.
No.
Here. I'm
going
to show you this thing. Yeah. What did you think?
Yeah, I had a very similar experience. I think that it took me a few days to kind of process how I felt about the whole thing or to just kind of get my mind around it. It's complex and it is outside of normal experience, right? It's... I remember distinctly when we were walking around, I did the tour with Sean, and I sort of looked through this little hole and saw this water bubbling up. And he's like, wait, let me turn on the lights. And I was looking down into hell. It was...
Yeah, he couldn't have planned that better, right?
Right.
to have an artist couldn't create that if they wanted to, and he just came across it, you know.
I guess we should... I want to kind of cop to something up front, too. I guess we should admit... Even though, you know, we had this conversation with Torben and Travis about the fact that they want people to be respectful and not just sort of giggle at the goofy guy. But let's be honest, part of the appeal is the strangeness, right?
Yeah, I think so. Totally. I mean, that is absolutely what made me interested in being there and have the experience. It was a moving, maybe that's not the right word, a moving experience in that it was so weird. It filled me with emotion and confusion and questions, which, I mean, I guess that's good for art to do. But it wasn't necessarily like, oh, this is like great art. It was a really interesting experience, which I don't know if that excludes it from being art.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the draw is it's a great story.
Yeah.
And I think the film does a great job of kind of giving you a sense of who he is, the emotion behind it. And, you know, we've all got that neighbor or that uncle or something like that we call kooky or we make fun of, but deep down they've got a core that we respond to, that we respect. And I think watching that film, I've already had people call me up or send emails about the film that were moved by it.
Yeah.
Moved by his story.
It wouldn't have worked if it was just laughing at him anyway, right? And no film would. I mean, if there's not an abiding respect for them, it's going to have a different effect.
I hope not.
Yeah.
I mean, I find examples of outsider artists here locally that I do think primarily exist because people are being snarky about them and they don't know how to interpret that. I mean, Raphael, I think, is aware of his outsiderness or whatever that means, being outside of society in some ways. Some of them aren't. And I think that people still find them weird and their story interesting. And sometimes I don't think it is quite as respectful as it might be in this case, partly because of his self-awareness.
Sure.
I think.
Let's talk about Gilgal Garden, because Adam, you said something interesting. You said you don't like Gilgal because it's weird.
I like Gilgal because I think that Thomas Child, who made it, and the story behind it.
Should we just explain what it is? I mean, it's this very odd sculpture garden off of Fifth South. People used to jump the fence back in the day. Now it's actually open. And
sort of the weirdest sculpture in there is the bust of Joseph Smith's. On a sphinx.
Yeah, yeah.
And the story behind it is that Tom Child was a construction worker, a contractor in town, and he...
And a Mormon bishop.
And a Mormon bishop, and he was having visions, and he was sort of making sculptures that represented his visions. But I'm interested in it because of the way this guy was creating significant, culturally significant artifacts that represented a really important part of what Mormonism does. I think about John Krakauer, actually, when I think about Gilgal Gardens and Under the Banner of Heaven. He talks about how Mormonism is this thing that encourages personal revelation, but also, institutional revelation. And those things can be at odds with one another sometimes. And I think that Raphael, and I think that Tom Child, and I think that others are representative of people who become their own prophet. They have their own sort of story to tell about their personal faith. And in this case, I think that in the case of Gilgal Garden in particular, I think that it is this really interesting manifestation of a really important segment of what it means to be Utahn, what it means to be Mormon. Mm-hmm. Even though it's not the mainstream take on that, it is a commonly reoccurring thing within Mormonism. And so I think that art, whether you're an outsider or a quote insider or whatever that means, I think that good art is something that holds a mirror up to our culture or that affects our culture in some way. It becomes significant because it makes us reconsider our own position relative to our culture. And I think Gilgal really does that well.
But does Raphael's work do that? Is it culturally significant? Sean, what do you think? Because that gets to the question. I mean, I'm not going to have you adjudicate what is art. But the question is does it rise to that same level? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's tricky if you're going to try to put things into boxes and say this is art, this isn't art.
Right.
And it really doesn't end up being very interesting, I think, in the long run.
It's true.
And so I think if you look at anything, visual art or novel or film, is it rich and is it interesting? And I think Raphael's is in that sense is, because it has this rich personal story about – it doesn't – really come out in the film as much, and I don't think Raphael will talk about it as much, but we got hints of it when we talked with him and went around the loss of his family members, his father and his daughter, and he had another daughter die later on, and they're painted on the ceiling inside. And it has, this layer of patriarchy, right? He's trying to restore a female presence to the sense of God, and he talks about the Holy Spirit as the comforter being a female thing. And so You could put all those layers. If he'd gotten an MFA, he would have learned how to put all those layers and make it look good and get it into a museum.
Yeah.
But he's not doing that. He's doing it for different reasons. But I think there's enough there. He might need to clean things up. He might need to get the lawnmower out that's inside. And,
yeah.
But even the clutter is interesting. Yeah, even the clutter. You walk in there and there's one gospel on the floor and a different gospel over here. And that's maybe part of the experience is when you go in there.
Does the artist have to get it? Adam, one of the things you talked about was this filmmaker. I'm really interested in the story of this filmmaker from Utah County. His name's Stephen Grew. And he has this really strange appeal to some people. He has this kind of cult following. The filmmaker Jared Hess, he has the good line, friends of ours who do local films, Joseph LeBaron and Travis Pitcher, are I think taken with this guy too. And he does these really, on the face of it, terrible films. Yet there's this kind of affection for it. Does he get it? Is he really trying to make these kind of doofy films, or is there something else going on? Does the artist have to get it, I guess?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I mean, Stephen Grew, in the movie Gentleman Broncos,
this is a Jared Hess.
Jared Hess used Stephen Grew as a pretty transparent model for one of the main characters, and it's my understanding that when Stephen understood that, he had a totally different take on his relationship with Jared Hess, yeah, where he had taken it as one of mutual respect. And I think Jared does respect him in a way, but I think that Stephen did not like the way that he was portrayed in the movie. And I think that that's a potential example of how there was a sort of maybe a lack of awareness about what the relationship truly was like, at least in Stephen's mind. And I mean, this is a problem, I think, anytime we talk about, quote, outsider art, is it's a really slippery thing to define. And it also puts us, the people calling it outsider art, inherently inside,
yeah,
the thing, whatever that is. And that's a difficult position to be in. It's a little bit complicated, I think. And it's difficult, as you mentioned earlier, I think, to not put yourself in a position where exploiting the artists or something.
You know, for 15 years now, I've edited articles on artists, I've written on artists, and even the inside artists don't agree necessarily with the quote-unquote critics.
Yeah.
And they don't have to. And that's, yeah, I think the point is, if something is rich enough for you to spend an hour on the radio talking about it, it's got some merit. There's something to look at there. What you want to call it, outsider art, kooky, whatever it is, doesn't really matter. It pulls our interest in. It makes for a good radio show.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. Basically, in preparing for this show, I asked on my Facebook page, I asked people to contribute the names of outsider artists in Utah, and people put their own names and all sorts of other things, hoping they'd get a show somewhere. Or I don't know. One person put a quote by Jerry Saltz, who's an art critic that writes for the New York Times and other places, one of the most prominent art critics in America. That quote was, "All artists are outsiders," you know, and I think that that's kind of true in its own way.
Adam Bateman, artist, curator, executive director of Contemporary Art Gallery Quack in downtown Salt Lake City. Sean Rossiter with us. Also an artist, executive director of Artists of Utah. It's a nonprofit visual arts organization. You can see the film that we've been talking about, The Gospel According to Raphael, on our website, videowest.org. We need to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're continuing our conversation now about outsider art, whatever that is. Sean Rossiter, executive director of Artists of Utah and editor of their magazine 15 Bytes, is with us. And Adam Bateman, executive director and curator of Quack, also with us. What I know we've been talking about, it's hard to define exactly what it is, outsider art. As a movement, though, did it have a sort of a beginning? Is it, do you see it as a kind of artistic moment having a beginning?
Yeah, it came out of kind of in the 40s and 50s out of France. There was an artist, Jean Dubuffet, who was interested in what he called art brew, or raw art. And yeah, that was art by children, art by people in mental asylums, just kind of a raw experience, people that had no training. Now, and then when it got imported to America, the idea, the umbrella for it kind of became outsider art. But by these days, everything is inside. You know, yeah, graffiti gets into museums, yep, and street art. It doesn't really matter. And it's kind of a porous label that doesn't really hold things very well. And they've come up with other terms. So one that probably fits Raphael's experience the most is they call visionary environments. And if you start looking for them, they're kind of all over the place. There's Gilgal Garden. If you go down on I-80 through Nevada, there's the Thunder Mountain, which is off the side of the road, kind, yep, of a crumbling hippie estate that was similar to the Watts Tower. There's a place up in Cody where a guy started building a house and he kept building it and building it. It has three or four stories, and then he fell and died from it. And you see him all around the world. And so he kind of fits within that. You kind of recognize, and they're usually not trained. They're usually not operating within the art world. They just kind of what brings them together, I would say, is an obsession. And I think that's what attracts people, is this obsession. What was interesting about Raphael's, in that whole space, everything was religious art, except there was one painting he did in the late 60s, and it was a Moby Dick, right? And it was this, which is about obsession. It's about following the white whale. And that's a very, it's a very American thing. It's, you know, Citizen Kane has it, totally. These things that possess us, and we're really drawn to that. And I think that's what draws us to these projects outside of any consideration of whether or not it fits into the art world or what, whether or not we consider it art.
And I think that some of those things, I think some of these kinds of questions are kind of problematic when you think about it. I mean, I think to some extent, when the term was coined in, like Sean was saying, in the 40s and 50s, especially like in the New York art world with the first exhibitions of, quote, outsider art, it was a real reaction against like this art scene that was basically comprised of a bunch of people that would drink at the same bar together and show at the same galleries together and all make the same kind of paintings, you know? And they were saying, wow, there's this interesting stuff happening over there. And if you think about art as being an academic discipline that is has like a true inside and there's kind of like this conversation happening, I think that there are lots of curators, for example, that might work in New York City that would look at a lot of the art that is part of the Utah art establishment as being, quote, outsider, based on the definitions of being outside of that academic conversation and being people that are untrained. So I think that the conversation gets really complicated. UMOCA has an exhibition up, and Jim Williams, like Raphael, turned his whole inside of his house into a self-portrait in some way, and it's this celebration of him doing this thing. But interestingly, Jim Williams has an MFA in art, a Master's of Fine Arts degree, and he's exhibited at UMOCA as an outsider, and he has the aesthetic of an outsider, and he was working in a cloistered way. So there are lots of questions about what it means to be an outsider in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like Sean said, it's getting really complicated. And to some extent, we're all outsiders. And to some extent, all the outside comes into the institution at some point.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be the director of an outsider art museum because you would have to wrestle with these questions. It would be annoying.
You know, you talked about culture, the importance of, you know, perception and culture in all of this. Utah, of course, home to a religion that's inspired offshoots and dissidents and agitators and reformers. What influence do you think that has on outsider art or art in general, like a reaction to, I mean, beyond it just being a reflection of inspiration, but also a reaction to, like, what role do you think Mormonism plays in all of that culturally? That's such a long question, isn't it? I mean, we could talk an hour about that, couldn't we? Yeah. Give it a shot in the next few minutes.
Well, it's an odd situation because Mormons for years were the quintessential American outsiders. Right, we were foreign to the rest of the country, and now we have modeled ourselves as the quintessential Americans, and we don't. We're not very comfortable with people who work outside our "quote unquote" norm, like Raphael. And he talked about having, you know, an architect from the church was his friend and would come in and liked his work, but then someone else would come in and would get upset about that, and that he talked about leaving the church because of that. He didn't want to upset people. And there's an interesting paradox. I've watched people who work within a Mormon realm that is not Orthodox. And so they cut themselves this tiny sliver of an audience, right? The people, because most of the people don't care about their religion. If they're not of the religion, they don't care about it. And the people that are of the religion don't like the unorthodoxy. And so they have this audience of five that they can speak to.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's a problem that we have in the state because we're not, the dominant culture isn't that open or interested into unorthodox views.
Yep. I mean, I think that's really well said, actually, Sean. Yeah. I mean, I already said the thing about Krakauer and that paradox, but I think that there is a specific thing that relates to both Mormonism encouraging a sort of like personal experience that can sometimes be divergent from the mainstream experience that becomes paradoxical. Mm. And so it really sets up an insider-outsider paradox. I also think that Mormons really maybe are predisposed for liking outsiders because Mormons really like the underdog, you know.
Half the state spent 2 years running around on bikes and suits and ties. They were the outsiders where they went. So we should be able to respect people like Raphael that seem a little bit different from us.
Let me say finally, since we're essentially out of time. Torben and Travis and Marissa are really trying to get attention to this piece of art. I guess you're hopeful that I mean, you know, there's a big question about what's going to happen. Is this thing going to get bulldozed eventually? But people should see it. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I wouldn't miss the chance. With the caveat, the warning, that you will be on a guided tour. Visitors are welcome, but you're on a guided tour. But it's worth it.
Yeah.
The guided tour is the best part.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm totally convinced about it. I think it's great. I think it's really, really interesting. But I think this is the question we should be asking ourselves as a community. What artist should we preserve? Like, how do we do this intentionally, and how do we think about this? Do we preserve someone just because they're on the periphery, or do we choose to preserve people and celebrate people that are more in the center? I don't know the answer to the question, but I think that it's an important question that we should be conscious about asking as we're making these kinds of decisions.
It's Adam Bateman, Executive Director and Curator of Quack. Adam, thanks very much for coming in. Sean Rossiter, Executive Director of Artists of Utah and the editor of their magazine, 15 Bytes. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks.
I'll just mention again, The Gospel According to Raphael. Go see it at videowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.